Americans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to.
Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Let's do it.
Thank you for downloading the very latest from peterbcollins.com. I want to thank the individuals who subscribe to this program and pay the expenses, like Andy Krieger, Christopher Welsh, Wendy Gebauer, and the individual in the Witness Protection Program who goes by Quaker Orts. I'm grateful to each and every one of you. Details about subscriptions are on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Two of my favorite writers join us in this episode. Thomas Frank of Harper's will be with us later in this podcast. He's been working on the new Armageddon, scheduled, according to the Mayan calendar, for December 21st. Be sure your insurance is paid up, will you? But first, we welcome back to our program the man who has made it safe for white men to rap. Calvin Bud Trillin is back with fresh off the presses, Dogfight, the 2012 presidential campaign in verse. Calvin Trillin, Bud to your homies, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Peter.
Nice to see you again, and you're holding up so well.
I thank you. I don't act surprised when you say it. Thank you.
So it was quite a campaign. I lost count of how many Republican debates there were.
Right.
But my favorite was the one that was co-sponsored by the Tea Party Express and the NRA, because I knew that they had my best interests in mind.
Right. I missed that. I didn't realize that happened. There were a lot of them. And the other thing that was remarkable about the campaign is that there were so many front runners.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like we used to go to the hole-in-the-wall gang camp, the camp that Paul Newman started for kids with cancer and blood disease. And at talent night, award night, mm-hmm. everybody wins an award.
Yeah.
For something.
Right.
In the first couple of years we were there as voluntary counselors, I didn't realize that was happening. But mm-hmm. then someone told me, oh, yeah, everybody gets an award. The Republican primary was pretty much like that. Everybody got to be front runner.
Yeah.
You just had to wait until the first front runner, the front runner ahead of you dropped out, and then you could be front runner.
Now, as a humorist, who were you rooting for the most? Would it have been Mr. 999?
I liked him, the Herminator.
Chloe does, too.
He had a good bark on him. But also...
Well, apparently he bit a couple of women back in the past, and
yes,
that ended...
So those were probably love bites, I think they call those.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When he left, there's a poem in here called Lamentation of the Late Night Comics,
mm-hmm.
How they're all gnashing their teeth and crying because he's left. And the last line is, could we have Donald Trump back, please? They really need somebody to kick around.
Yeah. Now, who scared you the most of these Republican contenders? Had he or, in a single case, she won the nomination?
Scare me in the sense that,
as a citizen,
that he might win?
Yeah, and the future of our country and all that stuff.
Oh, well, I don't think that the people... I mean, I don't think Donald Trump, for instance, could have possibly won.
Mm-hmm.
Santorum didn't seem to understand the Constitution very well. This book has some passages that are called A Pause for Prose.
Yes.
And one of them is Rick Santorum taking over the homeschooling in his house. I guess his wife ordinarily does it. And little Kevin Santorum after Rick Santorum says the founding fathers didn't really believe in the separation of church and state,
mm-hmm.
little Kevin says, Timmy says that that's a phrase from Jefferson, separation of church and state. And there's a long pause, and Rick Santorum said, Timmy is inhabited by Satan. And little Kevin said, Timmy Burnside? It's Timmy Burnside who lives down the street?
Well, you know, what really shocked me is when Rick Santorum started talking about birth control as evil. And right. when he first brought it up, I laughed. I said, what a crazy thing to do in a campaign. And then the newly minted Cardinal Dolan dropped a video and launched a whole PR campaign to organize Catholics to get the government to do what the bishops weren't able to do, which is to get Catholics to stop using birth control.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the statistic in any surveys that have been done is 98% of Roman Catholic women either do use or have used birth control.
Not including Rhythm. That doesn't include the Rhythm.
No, right. Birth control. And as I think it was Saturday Night Live where somebody said, and the other 2% are the people in the church organizing the softball game. So it was strange to think we were discussing such things, in which the relevant court case, which was Griswold v. Connecticut, I think was settled in 1961 or something like that.
It's in that era, yeah.
I mean, the idea we'd be talking about it again. And then also, will you think of what would happen if you hired a political consultant who specialized in women's votes, and she came in and said, what you need to do is to have a couple of candidates bring up the subject of rape as not an unmitigated evil, but something that has its good points and bad mm-hmm. points, may have been intended by God.
And let's give credit here, because it was Charles Jaco, C.D. Jaco, who has a television show in St. Louis, who asked Todd Akin that question
yes.
that produced the original legitimate rape bizarre comment. And then it was unbelievable, because Richard Murdoch, this Tea Party guy running right. in Indiana who had knocked off Richard Lugar in the primary, right. Started spouting the same nonsense. And of course, you point out in a couple of your poems, Calvin, that what the Republicans were able to dodge was that Paul Ryan supported all of those same bills,
no, exactly.
that no exception for incest or rape, and yet he was able to distance himself from Todd Akin and make him seem like a moron. When Ryan and all the other real Neanderthal Republicans hold right. the exact same position.
Well, actually, Murdoch and Akin didn't agree completely. And it would have been an interesting debate in the Republican primary of whether you should have the baby in case of rape because God intended it, or, on the other side, Todd Akin saying, you wouldn't have the baby anyway because legitimate rape shuts the whole thing down.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a poem in here called The Female Reproductive System, a lecture by Todd Akin, a member of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology.
Yeah, yeah. Remarkable stuff.
It was. And of course, It was a terrible problem for Mitt Romney, because every time he tried to move to the center, which he did, which traditionally candidates do in presidential elections in America.
The etch-a-sketch moment, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in that second debate where he dropped all that sort of neocon bomb everybody stuff, I did a poem called Mitt Romney Beats His Swords into Plowshares. And then in the third debate, he got even softer, and I wrote a poem called Mitt Romney Beats His Plowshares into Feather Dusters.
Now, before we move on from the primaries, we've got to give special mention to the lunatic from Texas, Rick Perry, because he charged in and was leading in the polls for a moment. He was this fresh new face. And he just proceeded to faceplant time after time. And there was that one moment where he was powering up into a memorized, scripted tidbit right. about how I'm going to go to Washington and shut down three federal departments. Right. And then he couldn't remember what two of right. them were.
Well, and I think what happened, and that was definitely the moment that he was out, but I think the reason it was the moment he was out is that it fit into his previous performance in the primaries. I think anybody can have a sort of a brain freeze, mm-hmm. but with him, it sort of fit into the idea that, as I said in one poem trying to rhyme Perry, the space between his hair is airy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people by that time pretty much thought of that. Also, I pointed out in one poem that with this big Texas act, with his cowboy boots and everything, that his bona fides is a real Texan, whereas a cotton farmer. And you don't really need horses to plant cotton. So if he were really authentic, he should be wearing bib overalls.
There wasn't much authentic about him. But what was interesting is as he was tanking, he actually got honest for a moment, and he launched those commercials that described Mitt Romney as a vulture capitalist. And that was yeah. one of the rare moments of honesty in the Republican debates.
Yes, and then Newt chimed in. Newt liked that. And then
right,
Newt
with Shelley's money from
yes,
Vegas.
Newt also, and I think in a devastating accusation, accused Mitt Romney of being able to speak French. There's a poem in there about that, too, because
right.
I thought that was one of the moments the campaign would say, well, if he speaks French, we don't want anybody like that.
Now, you have the fully annotated vision, version of Dogfight there, so feel free when you mention these poems to whip one out and read
okay.
us a sample. And tell us a little bit about how you did this. Do you have a TiVo or a DVR, and did you watch all that Drek and then in the moment write a poem, or did you kind of sporadically sit down and capture what happened, say, in the weeks or months before?
I started in the spring, and I made notes. I sort of wrote what happened that week,
mm-hmm.
and I started a little bit of the poetry, but I didn't really get to real time writing the long narrative poem in until I guess late in the summer,
mm-hmm.
And then I handed in the book. The last chapter of the book, I handed it in takes, but I handed it in the last chapter 2 days after the election,
mm-hmm.
and it existed as a book the next Tuesday.
Wow!
I told my editor, I take back almost everything I've ever said about the inefficiency of the publishing industry.
Well, Random House had it printed in Korea or China.
I don't know which country.
Well, it was outsourced, right. wasn't it?
I assume. I don't know. I don't know anything about publishing.
And didn't Random process. House just merge with Condé Nast?
No, Random House was bought by Bertelsmann.
Bertelsmann, the Germans,
a few years ago, and then they just announced a merger or takeover of Penguin.
Mm. Oh, right. Yeah. How does that make you feel?
Not like a penguin. I'm glad to see that they're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
They just gave everybody who works there a $5,000 bonus.
Really?
This was partly on the strength of the fact that they're the American publishers for 50 Shades of Grey.
Right.
It is 50, right? Or is it 40?
It's 50.
50,
yeah. But if they'd been,
I don't mean to imply that you've read it, Peter. I just thought you might know about it.
But if they've been purchased by Goldman Sachs, the bonuses would have been in the millions.
Yeah, well, we've known that for a long time. We're in the wrong business.
Now, while we're talking about money, you have chronically complained about your undercompensation at The Nation magazine. And I'm volunteering to be your agent. I've met Ms. Vandenhuvel on a couple of occasions.
Right.
And I think she's really bright, and she's very,
very
attractive.
Bright. Very attractive, very bright. I wouldn't count generosity among her
I see.
Gifts. Although she didn't set the pay scale, I have to say.
Is that Victor responsible
yeah,
for that?
That was done by the person I call the wily and parsimonious Victor S. Novasky, who
uh-huh.
was her predecessor. And it was the pay scale was set originally in a column I used to do there when famously he said, when I asked him how much he intended to pay for each column, something in the high two figures. And that's when I employed my high-powered literary agent and said, play hardball.
Yeah.
And he got him up to 100.
Okay.
And
that's the low three figures.
That's the low three. And then when I when I sent him the first deadline poem, I didn't realize then it was a deadline poem, but the first political poem I wrote, which was inspired by John Sununu, who was a person famous for wanting to be the smartest person in the room and showing you that he was the smartest person in the room. I did a poem called If You Knew What Sununu, and I sent it to the old W&P, and he said he would pay me $100, the same as for a column, even though a poem is shorter than a column.
Right.
And
so by the word, that's a raise.
Well, yeah, it is. And I followed that up because I found out that poets in America are normally paid by the line. And at that point, and probably is still true, the highest payer was the New Yorker, and they paid $10 a line.
Mm-hmm.
So all I had to do to be the highest paid poet in the United States was to write a four-line poem, or even a two-line poem, be even better.
Mm-hmm.
So I've often said that any time I want to get the buzz you get for working at the absolute top dollar in your field, I write a two-line poem.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the first ones was when Lloyd Bentsen was named, the Texas senator was named Secretary of Treasury. I wrote a poem about his relations with special interest groups. The man is known for quo pro quidness. In Texas, that's how folks do business. That's $50 a line.
That's beautiful.
And
and where did you spend that? I mean, do you go to Elaine's and order a cocktail? Or
I thought once about saving all this money from the nation and buying a billboard and putting something on the billboard about the chintziness of the wily and parsimonious Victor S. Novasky. And then when George W. Bush's college transcript was revealed in the 2000 primaries with no apparent effect on the campaign, I did a poem called Obliviously On He Sails With Marks Not Quite As Good As Quails.
I remember that.
I did a four-line poem in 2008 on Mitt Romney, which that's $25 a line, which was, yes, Mitt's so slick of speech and smooth of garb, he reminds us all of Ken and Barbie, so quick to shed his moderate regalia, he may, like Ken, be lacking genitalia.
Now, Dogfight is one long narrative poem about the presidential campaign.
Right. We're not being afraid of the word epic here. I would say a long narrative epic poem.
I'm not afraid.
Good.
Yeah.
About the campaign. And then there are other poems embedded in it.
Mm-hmm. And some of these have previously appeared in The Nation.
Yes, not the long narrative
poem. And so
poem.
You're double dipping.
Absolutely. I prefer to say recycling, considering, really, the Earth's limited supply of fossil fuels and poetry.
Well, don't tell Katrina. She'll want to cut your pay. Or call Foxconn and get somebody to do it over in China for you.
Well, she might. I think that if I had been negotiating with Katrina, I might be really a rich man today.
Yeah.
But the wily and parsimonious plays it pretty close to the vest.
Yeah. So you've been on this book tour. You have to give the same spiel over and over again. What is the least recognized tract here in the new book that you're most proud of that you'd like to just bring forward right now? Because all the Ken and Barbies who haven't read your book and interview you never bother to ask.
Well, I like a poem I wrote just after the campaign. It's not in the book, which is called Republican Soul Searching. We're searching our souls and we're wondering why we got beat so badly, our rivals are gloating. It's obvious now where our campaign went wrong. We should have prevented more people from voting.
Now, wasn't that remarkable? Because I had two grave concerns about this campaign. It was so close in the polls that it appeared to me that it was within the reach of graft. And the temper tantrum that Karl Rove threw on Fox News on election night indicated to me that he had bought and paid for the results from Ohio, and they weren't coming in the way he had ordered them. So one of the takeaways was that the money did not buy the kinds of votes that we all feared from the Citizens United decision.
Well, it was sort of comforting that all of that money didn't actually turn the election. There is actually somebody in New York, a man named Mark Crispin Miller.
Oh, I know Mark.
You know Mark,
sure.
Who has written a lot about
stolen elections,
voter machine fraud, and stolen elections.
Yeah.
Who said that? And I think in a blog or an email or something that he thought that was absolutely right. That Rove was counting on that voting machine company,
mm-hmm.
and he thought they had it done, and they didn't have it done. I have no idea whether that's true, but
yeah.
But
did you see the story the Times ran about Mark Miller? It was right around Election Day, and they profiled him in order to ridicule him and make him into a tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist because he has done in-depth research on both 2000 and 2004.
Right.
And there's a healthy body of evidence that both of those elections were stolen.
Yeah, I didn't see that story.
Yeah.
Of course, the another way to look at the election is that simply for the same reason there were constant other front runners, is that they nominated the wrong guy. He wasn't a very good candidate.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly wasn't a very good candidate. He was stiff and another poem I like is inspired by when he went to his home state of Michigan, and he said, "I love this state. It seems right here. The trees are the right height. Away from here, I find no trees that please, no trees at such a perfect height as these. For me, I cannot ever be at ease with trees that grow no higher than one's knees, or two tall trees that splinter in a freeze. Wisconsin sure has bragging rights on cheese, and California's rich in Cantonese, and Colorado's where to take your skis. Connecticut, of course, has Lyme disease. And none of these am I prepared to sneeze, but here we have the perfect height of trees. I know that I will never see a sight as lovely as a tree whose height is right."
And can I just reprise right above that, you make a reference to Mitt's casual comment about the couple of Cadillacs. It might, for Mitt, they said, be all she wrote. His casual talk was still quite far from supple. He mentioned Ann owned Cadillacs, a couple. He loved not just the cars here, Romney said, but how high trees extend above one's head. Did you manage to work in the car elevator in La Jolla? I didn't see
I missed the car elevator in La Jolla. He wasn't a good candidate, and he had almost the Richie Rich stuff. He had almost a tick to mention it when it wasn't necessary to mention.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, of course, the 47% thing, as it turned out, as we saw from his speech to donors after the election, was actually what he felt.
Mm-hmm.
He actually believes... that inspired a blues song that I wrote called "I've Got the Mitt Thinks I'm a Moocher, a Taker, Not a Maker Blues."
Mm-hmm.
But he actually thinks of those people as really enjoying being victims and being on the dole and being supported by government. And I'm not sure he knows about people who are working two jobs and may pay more in payroll tax than he pays by percentage that he pays in income tax.
Mm-hmm.
I think it turns out that's what he actually believes. So,
yeah.
You know, some of the stuff about him was sort of gotcha stuff when he said, "I don't care, I'm not worried about the poor." And there were some things that came out of his mouth that, particularly in these days of instant sort of viral reaction on the web. But the Boca Raton thing, I think, was a real turning point of the election.
Well, let's come back to that in a second, because I agree there were some gotcha moments,
right.
and Romney stepped in those a
yes.
few times, but they built the whole theme of the Republican convention around a quote taken way out of context from President Obama.
Oh, absolutely.
You didn't build this thing.
Yes.
And it was breathtaking to see that hyped, recycled, and spun up. as if it really was an honest statement of Barack Obama.
And in fact, I read somewhere just recently that the survey showed that that actually, that doing that didn't have much effect on voters. I mean, they knew who Obama didn't think that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that any of those gotcha things, they only work, like when poor old Quayle, we worry about him, when poor old Quayle was caught not knowing how to spell is either potato or tomato, I can't remember. And I was a little sympathetic because I'm not a very good speller myself. But it wouldn't have worked if, say, Bill Clinton didn't know how to spell tomato or potato, because whatever you think about Bill Clinton, nobody doubts his intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
He's smart. And so I think that these gotcha things only work if they go along with a picture that people have of the candidate to start with.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the videotape and the 47%, feisty little magazine here in San Francisco, Mother Jones,
right,
got a hold of that video and released it. And you have your own theories about the origins of that video.
That's right. That's right. David Corn, who used to be with The Nation, got that. He's the Washington man for Mother Jones now, deserves mm-hmm. a lot of credit. And I also think that Jimmy Carter's grandson was involved. I saw him interviewed.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm.
He saw snippets of it, but he traced it. But it's surprising to me that we still don't know who did it. And some people say, well, it's probably a waiter, but it seems unlikely to me.
We can exclude Bradley Manning.
Yes, he's out of commission. I like to think it was one of the fat cat donor's wives. She hates her husband. She likes the house in Boca Raton. She likes the Lexus. She loves the private plane, but she hates her husband. So she snuck it in and did it. I prefer to believe that.
Now, Bud Trillin, I want to confess that I grew up in Ohio.
Right.
And to see it become the battleground and the swing state where millions of the $2 billion spent by the two campaigns
right.
were spent on misleading television ads. And in the last cycle, we had Joe the Plumber come out of Ohio. And
I had almost forgotten about Joe.
He ran for Congress and lost, fortunately.
Right.
But one of the interesting things was that both campaigns tried to use a call and response where the candidate would say, O-H, and the crowd would respond, I-O. And it was kind of like the old YMCA thing from
right.
the Village People
right.
or something like
right.
that. But both campaigns used it. And you kind of picked up on that because you wrote your own little ode to Ohio.
Yeah, I wrote, what page is that on?
I found it on page 97 in my book.
Well,
perhaps it's the same for you.
Probably on the same page. There, as I say, I didn't take back all of my criticism of the efficiency of the publishing industry, so it might be on some other page.
Well, let's see if they do match. 97 comes right between 96 and 98.
Same in
again
my book.
In my book. Yeah,
this is a version of the song from Wonderful Town. Why oh why oh why oh why did I ever leave Ohio? Why did I locate where since it's no spring swing state, pollsters don't trouble to track. Zero is my vote's weight. Reason to vote? That's what I lack. Oh, why, oh, did I leave Ohio? Maybe I better go O-H-I-O, where I could have my vote back.
Now, what you're underscoring there is that here in California, my vote didn't matter.
That's right.
And while there was a bizarre event the night before the election, I was watching Jeopardy because I was just, I'd had it.
Right.
I couldn't take any more. And during one of the commercial breaks, there were three spots in a row, and they all had the exact same theme. They were white women with a child in the picture, and the script was that they had voted for Obama last time, but they couldn't do it again. So the first one came from Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers
right.
Front group. The second one was from a super PAC, and the print was so small, frankly, I looked
right.
at it three times.
That's
but
the name of that super PAC, the small print super PAC.
The third one was officially from the Romney campaign, and they all used the exact same message with different characters.
Well, they're not coordinating, right?
Of course not. Yeah. But aside from that, California was not in play. Well, and I'm going to confess to you that I didn't even vote for Obama because I'm so far to his left that I voted for Rocky Anderson, the former mayor of Salt Lake City, who founded the Justice Party to try to get me my Fourth Amendment and a couple other of those little things from the Bill of Rights back in action.
He's a former ACLU attorney, Rocky.
Yeah.
How'd he do?
Well, he got my vote. We had to write him in California.
I think the other thing about Ohio is the polls. I have a poem here, the end of a chapter. It says the polls no longer occupied our time, with speeches gone, the silence was sublime. Auteurs of cutting ads had sheathed their knives. Ohio folks could get back to their lives. They answer telephones without the fear of the questions from a pollster's what they'll hear. And pop off to the grocery store. Pop off to the grocery if they choose, without the fear of being on the news.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little poem that says, "Of course, it's an honor to be called by all the state that elects the commander in chief. But now that it's over, the sound around here is not lots of weeping, but sighs of relief."
Yeah. Well, it is over. And what occurs to me, Calvin Trillin, is that this new book, Dogfight, with your verse related to the presidential campaign of 2012, would make a heck of a Christmas gift. Did you think of that?
I would say it has stocking stuffer written all over it.
Well, and it's small enough that it would actually fit in my stocking.
There are some people who believe it would fit in the toe of your stocking.
Yes, I think
so. But it's 154 pages, something like that, but small format.
Mm-hmm.
I think that somebody mentioned that it could qualify as something that I never thought I would write, a slim volume of verse.
Yeah. Well, Calvin Trillin, it's always a pleasure to see you. Thanks for this contribution. It will help us relive some of the more humorous events of this past election cycle.
Thank you, Peter.
Harper's Thomas Frank returns to our program today, and now he's an expert on doomsday. That's Skeeter Davis from 1963. It's called The End of the World, IND. And Thomas Frank returns to our program. He, of course, wrote What's the Matter with Kansas? And we used to apply him with bad rock music from the band Kansas, but we've eased up on that lately. His most recent book is Pity the Billionaires, and he writes the Easy Chair column for Harper's Magazine, which is so important that it appears in the magazine before the Harper's Index and is given a pass. The Harper's Index never actually cites the information from Easy Chair to push more statistics our way. And Tom Frank joins us by Skype from his library, and he was kind enough to get dressed for us, although he reports that he does not have any pants on right now. Hello, Tom.
Hey, Peter.
How you doing?
Well, I'm good, except for I've got something to go to, and I don't have any pants on yet. and there's a bit of a draft in this room.
Well, I'm sure that you will sort it all out in due course. Your piece this month recaps the end of the world, which is scheduled for December 21st, based on the Mayan calendar, and a new cottage industry of books and other materials exploiting that prospect. What was it like to get steeped in the latest Armageddon moment?
Well, at first you start to wonder if maybe they've got something, you know, because the first sort of bit of end of the world culture that I did was I watched I watched that movie, the 2012 movie that came out, I think, 2 years ago. I'm blanking on the director's name now. It's a German guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it depicts all these different disasters happening at once, and it's kind of frightening. But then you know me, I can never just watch something and just enjoy it. I always have to pick it apart and think about it. And sure enough, and by the way, you're not broadcasting this, are you?
Oh yeah, eventually we will.
Oh okay, because I was going to use some blue language to.
Oh well, it will be podcast, but your language is unrestricted here. You can say whatever the fuck you want.
Okay, so after a while, you just realize that it's all bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all bullshit. It's such utter malarkey. And a lot of these books are bestsellers. A lot of them are written by people who seem to be very authoritative. There's one by a guy, he worked for the New York Times for years, I think. And it's very well written.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading it, and it's only after a while, you know, when you start digging around in the research yourself, you start realizing that they're using every manner of trick to, you know, stack the deck in a certain way and make everything seem much worse than it actually is. There's a whole industry out there dedicated to frightening people.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this is really part of the culture right now. I didn't have the space to go in this direction, but you remember the Tea Party movement, right, Peter?
Oh yeah,
B?
Yeah.
fond memories of those guys.
Well, it's it's the ship that Dick Armey and Jim DeMint have just jumped off.
Yeah, that's right. Although DeMint is actually just I don't know. What do I know? I don't have any privileged information about them anymore. But if you watched Glenn Beck back at the height of this movement was really propelled by this doomsday fantasy. A lot of different doomsday fantasies. It's no coincidence that Glenn Beck's favorite sort of figure from broadcasting is Orson Welles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the famous War of the Worlds broadcast where he scared everybody into thinking that the Martians had invaded. That's Glenn Beck's. That's his shtick. That's what he does.
Well, and he even stole the name Mercury. He uses Mercury as his company name, and that was the theater group that Welles.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
He took that from Welles. He took a whole bunch of different things from Welles, from Orson Welles, except for the politics, of
mm-hmm.
course.
Mm-hmm.
Can't have that. That is the sort of what would you say? That's the cultural touch. You know, that is the point of departure for the Tea Party movement. That's really what they got off on, mm-hmm. was doomsday scenarios. They loved that stuff, that end of the world stuff. But what I looked at for Harper's this month is the secular version. Well, it's actually not secular. It's it is secular. The Mayan religion. I mean, mm-hmm. this is not one of the people that I read. Okay, maybe one is actually like trying to practice the Mayan religion or really believes in the Mayan religion. I mean, what we know about it. And this is one of the huge tragedies that you immediately come face to face with here is that we know very little about the ancient Maya, mm-hmm. as opposed to, say, like the ancient Greeks or the ancient Egyptians or something like that. We know very little about them because so much of their books and their writing was destroyed by the conquistadors, you know, which is an enormous tragedy, but that's the way it is. We mm-hmm. really don't have a very good idea what the significance of any of this stuff was for them, and as a result, we really don't know what the significance of the end of their calendar was. Maybe you just like turn it over and start a new one. You gotta, that's almost certainly what the answer is. You know, but they're interesting people. Calendars were very central to their religion, and they had lots of different ones. Right, they had a day to day sort of calendar, but they had a lunar calendar, and they had calendars charting the various celestial bodies, and then they had what's called the long count calendar, and that's the one that is ending this month.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even remember what the long count calendar counts. I've completely forgot. Yeah, but its cycles are hundreds of years. That's it's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
And
now, how does this compare with the Christianist end times predictions that were popularized in the Left Behind book series that came out of the Lynchburg?
Left Behind.
You have?
And I finally threw it out today. I literally took it out to the recycling bin and put it in the trash because, you know, it'll go and get pulped and turned into, you know...
something useful.
Something useful, yeah. It's so bad. I had never read it before. And I decided after I wrote this essay, it's like, I better read that thing. You know, that's this is kind of interesting. And it's, you know, it's fun to read. It's a page turner, but it's so badly written. And the whole sort of what would you call it? The whole sort of thesis of it is to conjecture about what the world would be like when all the good people are gone and like the world is in the hands of secular liberals like you. And that's all there is. These poor, you know, deluded secular liberal fools trying to figure everything out. And Christianity is such a puzzle to them. You know, they can't even, you know, figure the basic things about it out. It's really, really hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow.
Now, you seem to be having way too much time when we're looking at just a couple of weeks left and everything's going to go up in smoke. I mean,
okay, so let me cut to the chase here, Peter B., before the world ends. You're exactly right. I don't know why I'm wasting your listeners' time when, you know, they're worried about the world ending.
And they're stockpiling lots of important items.
No, we'll come to that in a minute, because that's a really interesting part of it, all the survivalist stuff. But look. This isn't the first end time scenario in our dumb lives. This is ever since I was a child. We've had you know, this end time scenario after that one. I'm from Kansas City. There's always some millennialist cult, you know, making headlines in Kansas City. It happens all the time. When I was a kid, my brothers and I used to subscribe to some free magazine. I don't remember the name of it now, but the whole point of this magazine was to clue you in on the various pieces of evidence that we were living through the end times. It always had to do with Israel and the Soviets and, you know, atomic bombs and this kind of thing. And we would get this every month, and it, you know, just because it was free. But the way these guys would so carefully piece together things that were happening in real life with, you know, verses from the Book of Revelation or from Ezekiel or whatever the other one is, Isaiah, I forget now. But that was their version of Christianity, was to really, really focus on this end time stuff. So I went back and read one of the sort of classic books about millennialist Christianity, you know, about the sort of Christian groups that really believe very strongly in the end times, where that's really what they're all about. And these groups all have certain cultural things in common, among other things. And this is very interesting. I'm sorry, I'm going to blank on a lot of this stuff, and I'm going to do a lousy job. But these groups have a real democratic side to them. They're very anti-hierarchical, and they're very anti professional. Mm-hmm. Okay, because these are 200-300 years ago, the top people in the Christian world, the most learned, you know, graduates of the most respected seminaries in America, would tell you about the end times, but nowadays, that's just not the case. You know, the people that talk about the end times tend to be self-taught. They tend to have a real chip on their shoulder about professional expertise because they have been kept out, right, by the so-called mainline Protestant experts or whatever you have you.
Elites.
They tend to be the elites. Mm-hmm. There's that word.
Yeah.
They tend to be freelancers. You know, and they tend to do all of this sort of scriptural interpretation all on their own. And there's something very charming about this. I mean, you have people who do this in their spare time. They're not accredited by any institution at all. They just are like, I'm going to sit down and write an interpretation of the Book of Revelation, you know, just for fun. I drive trucks during the day, but at night I'm going to sit down and write this and, you know, and then publish it on the internet or something like that. And that is the culture of the sort of Christian millennialist various movements. And what was really fascinating to me was to see these all of these cultural themes repeated in the Maya end times, the 2012 end times stuff. It, you know, just almost note for note, it's a cover version of the old Christian rapture stuff, minus the Christianity. Mm-hmm. Right? Nobody's going to be saved or anything like that.
Wow.
You know.
Well, now, just before our recent election, the Nat Geo and War Channel broadcast the SEAL Team 6 feature TV, made-for-TV movie, and I actually watched it. In between, we saw all these promos for a show called Doomsday Preppin'.
Yeah, Doomsday Preppers. Yeah, I watched it.
And I didn't. I saw the promo, and I just thought, what a crock of shit. But you've actually sat through an episode or two. What do they do?
Several of them. It's a hoot. But there's this other side of Christian millennialist tradition which holds that, first of all, through careful study of the Bible, or in our modern version, our secular version, through careful study of Mayan hieroglyphics, we can determine exactly when the end times are going to take place. But here's the catch. We're like, okay, it's going to be the end of the world for everybody else, but I am going to escape, you know, and which raises all kinds of problems with, predestination. A lot of these things that Christians ordinarily debate among themselves, you know, if you think God is really going to end the world, where do you get off stockpiling, you know, freeze-dried soup and stuff like that? He's ending the world. How dare you defy him? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But there's this whole culture of survivalists that want to that are determined to survive whatever the end time scenario is that they see coming, and it's a really, really popular and growing subculture, and it all involves stockpiling shit. And stockpiling, buying a second, and especially getting a second location to stockpile more shit, because you can't stockpile enough shit in your suburban house, and it's not safe, because if the neighbors have figured out you're stockpiling shit in your suburban house, when the balloon goes up, they're going to come and take it from you. Okay?
But that's so, why you have to be heavily armed at all times.
Yeah, that's an important codicil here. You have to be heavily armed. And so I watched several episodes of the show. I taped it on my TiVo and watched them. And it's very interesting. And we'll get to – I mean, and I have a certain survivalist bent myself, which we can talk about in a minute. But so I was watching it both because I was writing this essay and I'm fascinated by this, but also because, you know, I need some advice for my own doomsday preparations, you know. And so I'm watching this thing, and and people give their tips for stockpiling. Like, look, I mix nitrogen with the stuff so that it doesn't rot quite as quickly. Or I've, you know, built this special water purification device, you know, and nobody else has one. And you know, these incredible things. Somebody's got a truck that runs on recycled engine oil or something
like
that.
And a generator that runs on marshmallows, right?
All these sorts of things, you know. And look, again, there's something very democratic about it. You know, the high and the mighty, you know, all of your money will be worth nothing, but the man that knows how to run a chainsaw will prevail, right? It's this very working class idea of, you know, blue collar guys will inherit the earth. The meek will inherit the earth, as long as they're really well armed.
Now, you teased us with some confessional here. What is your own attraction to this?
We'll get to that. First, I want to tell you the funny part of it. What I think was is the most amusing part, which is, it's not just about people preparing for doomsday. They do that, and then they go through their preparations and they describe them in great detail and film them, stockpiling shit or whatever it is, building their special a car that runs on firewood or whatever it is. But they have to, each person gives their special reason for why they're doing this, their special doomsday scenario that they have worked out in their own head. And what's funny is they've been very scientific in all of their preparations. You know, it's very matter of fact, very scientific, but their theories for why the world is ending are just completely totally head up their ass stupid, you know. It's like, so after I watched many, so people think like there's going to be a polar shift, Peter B, where the North and South Pole are going to swap, and everything is going to come loose from its moorings. It's going to be terrible. A lot of people believe hyperinflation is coming. This is a really common one.
Right.
It's going to be hyperinflation. There's going to be riots in the cities, you know, all this kind of thing. A lot of people believe in this is actually the most practical one that I saw. A lot of people believe that there's some kind of super flu epidemic that's going to hit. Mm-hmm. That's actually, you know, something to be worried about. A lot of people are still worried about a nuclear exchange with the Soviets.
Oh, great.
But here's the thing that really got me about all this. All of these different end time scenarios that people have, you know, and they're often very confused. Like people think, oh, the federal deficit is so large, doomsday must be around the corner. You know, it's just gotta be. So I'm gonna take all these measures, you know, stockpile all this crap. But nobody that I saw mentioned global warming. You know, the doomsday thing that is actually coming.
right.
Nobody was planning for that. They're all planning for to fight off the mob with a you know, machine gun or something, you know, or a flamethrower or something like that. Nobody is actually planning on, you know, defeating global warming, which is actually coming for your ass.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really intriguing. Instead, they've dreamed up all these bizarre scenarios that, you know, and complete misunderstandings of how, like, the federal deficit works and stuff like that.
Well, and clearly nobody's prepping for doomsday in Lower Manhattan. Yeah, or Staten Island.
Not a lot of survivalists there, you know.
Yeah.
It's not. Look, I'm in suburban DC. You'd think this would be a place where people would be. Well, we'll get to that in a second. There's not many. If you watch the show very often, you notice these people all go to these superstores that sell stuff to doomsday preppers. What they call themselves preppers. The stores, they don't have them on the East Coast. They don't have them here in Washington, D.C.
Oh, really? Not worth it.
That's right. I looked into it. Why did I look into it, you might ask? Well, I think all of these scenarios that these people have are bunk, but I live in suburban Washington, D.C., and this place has got, like, the big terrorist bullseye on it. I mean, there's every terrorist in the world wants a piece of this place. And as we saw after Hurricane Katrina, I mean, look, Obama is no doubt, you know, better. The FEMA is better run today than it was under Mike Brown. Remember Brownie? I mean, but after when that happened, that scared me. And I realized that these people, they don't give a damn about the population of this city. They'll get their own people out, but the rest of us are just going to have to fend for ourselves. And so, you know, to be responsible, I worked at, you know, you got to stockpile about a week's worth of crap, water and, you know, freeze dried food and all that stuff, and be ready for when if the water supply gets. Another thing is we lose power here all the time. So for me, it's just a responsible thing. But I'm certainly not like, you know, buying weapons or anything.
So do you have
like
a generator?
No, because my neighbor's got one.
You've got a gun. He's got a generator. You're a pair.
No. I don't have a gun. I just said I don't do that. No, both of my neighbors actually have generators. Everybody's got one of those right here because the power. We live in this area with these mature trees, you know, and they're forever dropping branches on the power lines.
All right, work with me, Tom. We're in a building that is filled with crazy people, and we've just closed the door.
You're in earthquake land, Peter B.
Let me finish. We've just closed the door on the doomsday preppers, and right down the hall is the door marked secessionists. So in Texas, even though Rick Perry doesn't support it now, 116,000 people have signed a White House petition demanding the right to secede from the Union. And they're copycats around the country. And it all seems to have burgeoned since the election and the fear of the socialism under Obama 2.0. What do you make of these people who believe?
It's a politicization of the same fear of this doomsday fear. Everybody, look, this is what we're coming to with all the different things that we're talking about: the Maya doomsday stuff, the Christian rapture stuff, these sort of secular doomsday preppers, and now these people that think that Barack Obama is a socialist or he's got some scheme or he's a Manchurian president.
You're gonna take my guns.
Yeah, that's right. He's actually been the weakest Democrat on gun control since, I mean, since what?
Since JFK was assassinated.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Mitt Romney actually had a claim to be more liberal than Obama on gun control because his governor met. But anyhow, we're getting off the track here. What we're coming to is that doomsday scenarios are attractive to people, and they will believe in them whether there's evidence for it or not. People like the idea of some final judgment where, you know, wrongs get righted and, you know, all that kind of crap.
Well, that's how it happens in the movies.
Yeah, exactly.
And on the TV.
And we expect that. We, you know, America always wins and the good side always prevails and all that sort of thing. But, you know, I just went to see the movie Lincoln. The secessionists don't come out too well.
No, they don't. I thought it was a pretty interesting film. And on another occasion, I want to get your detailed commentary on it.
Next month. We'll talk about that. It's going to be my next essay in Harper's.
All right. But your time is limited. You got to find some pants and go to a dinner party.
Yeah. But so, we didn't really get to talk about the Maya stuff. But I wanted to bring up some interesting themes in the Maya doomsday literature.
Okay. And then you got to give me 5 minutes to recap the election. And then you can go to your dinner party and find your pants.
It's really similar to the Christian rapture literature in that it is a lot of these authors are self-taught. They all seem to have a big chip on their shoulder about professional expertise, and particularly about anthropology. And they also have there's this whole this combination of reverence for technology and how would you put it? Idea of hubris that Americans are trying to get too far above themselves. If you go and watch the 2012 movie, I remember the director's name now. His name is Roland Emmerich. The scientists in it are moaning. It's like, oh, we, you know, all our great technology and all our fancy machines, and the Mayans saw this coming 4,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they proceed to build some super high tech remedy so that the human race survives the doomsday with our fantastic technology. But that's the themes of this literature. And what's fascinating to me is that it's the exact same themes that was in the Christian millennialist literature, you know, for the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. It's just been transferred into this other realm.
Well, there are only so many ways to end that story, and they do seem to tread on similar ground.
That's exactly right.
I want to hear your thoughts about the election and the extent to which some people, and slightly more people than the last time, voted their self-interest instead of being distracted by the big money Karl Rove messages, by the lies and distractions of the Romney campaign, starting with the phony premise of the convention, you didn't build that.
Yeah.
And I see a little sliver or glimmer of hope here that the rejection of all of that money that was poured into negative ads, mostly pushing people's hot buttons about same-sex marriage or, you know, other emotional/religious issues, that did not deliver the way Rove was able to count on those people, say, back in 2004 when he ran all those state-level initiatives against gay marriage.
That's exactly right. And that is a hopeful sign. But look, at the end of the day, you know, you have a very populist situation out there, you know, where everybody can see what's going on, you know, in terms of the economy and Wall Street. And who do the Republicans nominate but one of the richest men in the country, a man who ran an investment bank himself or whatever you want to call Bain Capital, buyout firm. I don't give a damn what you call it, but this is a guy. One of the sort of rules of thumb of American elections is that the more populist of the candidates wins, you know, going back, I don't know how far you want to go back, but it's always the guy. Remember that thing that used to always – that annoying phrase he used to always say during the Bush years, who would you rather have a beer with? And look, the Republicans chose a guy who was so far away from the average American, you know, that he might as well be from a different country. This is a guy – you remember when he wanted to bet Rick Perry $10,000?
Right, yeah.
I mean, all of these things. The business with the Cadillacs. What kind of car do you drive? Well, my wife drives a couple of Cadillacs. The NASCAR thing. Do you remember this?
Sure.
They asked about NASCAR, which has always been one of their touchstones, their populist touchstones.
Right.
And he says, no, I don't follow the sport, but I know a couple of guys who own NASCAR teams. What a candidate. What a dreadful, dreadful, awful candidate. Now, you know what would have been interesting? Is if they what would have made it an interesting race is if they had chosen one of their populist guys. Now Santorum would have probably been a disaster, but you remember the reason he was on fire in the primaries is that speech he would give about his grandfather, the coal miner.
Yeah.
You remember that? And that
sure.
was really touching. Now he would immediately segue from that into this like insane crap about how we have to cut taxes. It didn't make any sense.
And birth control.
But in terms of that populist confrontation, these guys were, you know, they weren't even on the map. Look, Romney was a lousy candidate. He was arguably better than the others, but, you know, this guy was I was surprised he got as close as he did, frankly. I thought Obama should have been a landslide. I mean, he should have demolished this guy. But yes, I'm glad he won. I'm happy about it. You know, you can't fool people forever. But I also think, I mean, here in D.C. especially, the Democrats are really chuffed at themselves. They think they've, you know, everything is going their way. The wind is at their back. The Tea Party is falling apart. They don't have to worry about conservatism anymore. I think they're too optimistic. You know, I think Obama had it in his power to finish these guys off this election, and he didn't do it. He could have, but he didn't want to. He, you know, that would have meant taking a chance. It would have meant rolling the dice.
Well,
and
it also
you know how politicians are. They never want to do that.
But we've seen in the past two-term Democrats that at their reelection point, they don't work to bring a Democratic Congress with them. They simply, you know, cover their own butts, and they do get reelected, but then they are consigned to these minority situations where they can't really prevail.
And you just described exactly what Obama and Clinton both did, but Obama didn't lift a finger for Democrats in the House, and that's, you know, maybe one or two of them, but that's all. He didn't really do much of anything for them. And that's – I mean, it's tragic. It's a huge missed opportunity. But it's also – I'm really sorry to say it's typical of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Bill Clinton. I mean, the whole idea of the Democratic Leadership Council when Clinton ran it and he was their blue-eyed boy was that they would win the presidency and they would forget about the rest. The presidency was all they cared about. I mean, this is a D.C. strategy. The presidency is all that matters. And I think that's a big mistake. But look, right now, he won. I'm happy to see that. Maybe he will bargain more toughly. Maybe he'll get some backbone. I hope so. I'm really happy for a couple of reasons. One, they're not going to be able to repeal health care. I'm real happy about that. Two, it looks to me like they're never going to overturn Roe v. Wade. I think that is that's just out of their grasp now, and I'm thankful for that.
But let's hope that Obama puts a real liberal on the court because the centrist pro-corporate people he's been nominating are safe and get confirmed.
You're totally right.
He needs to rebalance the court.
I'm just trying to look on the bright side here because you asked me to.
I did?
I got to go, Peter B. I got a dinner party to go to here in swanky Bethesda, man.
Well, let's wrap up here. And I'll look forward to rehashing some of this in the future. We'll have a little distance from the election next time we talk. And I certainly enjoyed how much you enjoyed the doomsday prepping.
Yes, it was wonderful stuff.
Thomas Frank. Here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And now, in his final appearance here on the Peter B. Collins podcast for 2012, San Francisco's stand-up comic sits us down for a little satire on the lame duck Congress. Take it away, Will.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few words on the current lame duck session of the 112th Congress. The final assemblage of this peculiar group of elected representatives on Capitol Hill, and of course, they're spending these last precious moments getting the American ship in order. Yeah, right, dream on, Big River. Mostly what they're doing is running around waving their arms, squawking about the imminent approach of the dreaded fiscal cliff. Calm yourself, kiddies. It's not a cliff. More of a slope. Slight incline. Nothing remotely close to a chasm, nor a gorge. Shall we say a rolling valley? A lush ravine, beribboned with a multitude of paved access roads. Unlike what they'd have us believe, it's less a screaming plunge off a sheer precipice, and more of a stroll on a knoll with a coal-colored foal. It's an artificial crisis, something our politicians specialize in. If the Bush tax cuts do expire as expected on December 31st, they can always vote them back in. And if it takes till February, they can do it retroactively. For everybody. For those making less than $250K. Whatever. Problem is, they'd rather not go on record voting for or against any sort of compromise, and are more than happy to play kick the can as long as possible, preferably through the open portal of a time machine into the distant future. These people are as useless as a Viagra dispenser at a Unix convention. Lame duck doesn't do them justice. Comatose vultures, perhaps. Brain-damaged fainting geese. Biologically deformed pterodactyl fossils encased in an amber pool of irrelevance, obsolescence, and guilt. Whoa. Okay, I'm done. Wait, one more. Quadriplegic platypuses. But on January 3rd, a new Congress will swagger into town, and looks like it'll be up to them to put the deficit can back in play. And if they need some ideas of where to put it, pretty sure we, their constituents, could come up with a few choice suggestions. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Calvin Trillin, Tom Frank, Will Durst. Thanks for the laughs. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.